first case, which is United States v. Smith. At some point, I think we're going to have a group of high school students, but I don't think they're here yet. When they do come, they're from John Bowne High School in Queens. And so we always are delighted to have high school students come and watch what we do. And they also get to go to the Learning Center on the fifth floor, where they get a better appreciation for the courts and the role of courts in our constitutional system. It's a nice thing, a legacy of Judge Katzmann that Judge Bianco has taken to even newer heights. So with that, we'll proceed. Mr. Dowling, you have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. So the floor is yours.
Good morning.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is John Dowling for the defendant appellant Taheem Smith. This case involves a secret, undisclosed plan to commit the murder of two people near a train station on Long Island in the summer of 2016. Both parties agree that the defendant, Taheem Smith, did not pull the trigger. Yet the government sought to hold Mr. Smith liable for aiding and abetting a crime that was planned.
And as a principal as well, right?
Yes, he was. But they've agreed that he didn't pull the trigger. So my position is that they would not have proceeded on that theory.
Well, but a felony murder doesn't require you to pull the trigger, right? Is your view that you can only be charged in a felony murder as an aider or abettor if you're not the person who actually inflicted the lethal force?
No, that's not my view, no. And with that, Your Honor, I'll cut right to the chase. We're not asking this court to dispense with the felony murder rule or somehow eliminate it in some way. What we're saying is that in this particular case, where the principal has a secret, undisclosed plan to not commit a robbery, but to commit premeditated murder and recruit somebody else to commit a what I'll call a garden variety robbery, not a murder, then it's a completely different playing field. And
that's a point that could have been pushed at trial. But I mean, you waive all that when your client pled guilty to a different count. He pled guilty to racketeering, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so the jury instruction that you're really focused on pertained to two counts that were dismissed, right?
Correct.
So why isn't all of this waived by virtue of the guilty plea?
Because it was our position is that it was a guaranteed conviction. If we had gone to trial on that jury instruction that Judge Brown of the district court held that he would have been given to the jury.
But you didn't reserve a right to appeal this issue, did you?
You did
not have a conditional guilty plea that reserved the right to appeal the question of whether specific intent was required for this crime.
In the traditional sense of a conditional plea, Your Honor, no, we didn't. But I do think that
In the traditional sense, what do you mean by that? You mean by in writing or orally?
No, because
I don't see either an oral reservation, which the court would have to approve and the government would have to consent to, or in writing.
Well, I mean in the traditional sense that we didn't use the words, this is a conditional plea. I think it's more
so. What words did you use? What words did you use instead of the traditional reservation?
The words that were used were, and I'm gonna quote from the plea agreement, that Smith agrees not to file an appeal or otherwise challenge the conviction or sentence in the event that the court imposes a term of imprisonment of 300 months or below.
Right, so, but the sole exception to the appeal waiver was that he would reserve his ability to challenge the suppression of statements, right?
That's not correct, Your Honor. If you look at it closely, the ability to challenge the district court's denial of the motion, the ruling on the suppression motion, that would have been preserved regardless of what sentence the district judge imposed. But here, the district judge...
Because you reserved the right to raise it on appeal.
Correct. But I think that what I'm saying is this. It wasn't a conditional plea in the sense that we typically think about under Criminal Rule 11 A2, but it was what I call a fixed plea. I think people have used different terms for this, but my understanding is that it was a fixed plea because the parties agreed that a particular sentencing range...
No, but you're suggesting that any sentence above the stipulated range allowed you then to challenge all aspects of the conviction and the sentence, right?
Yes, that's my position.
But
yes,
the district court was explicit that you might have the right to appeal the sentence, but not on the question of whether you did this or not, right? Isn't that what... That's from the transcript.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that the district judge, he acknowledged the threshold of 300 months. He acknowledged that during the plea colloquy. And it appears that he accepted that plea agreement and then went right past that amount at sentencing.
But, I mean, there are two things being confused here. A plea agreement under which a defendant waives, and then it waives the right to appeal, and the normal consequence of a guilty plea. When you plead guilty, no matter, unless the district judge denies this, says something that's contrary to it, the normal consequence of pleading guilty is that you lose the right to contest your guilt on appeal. You can't go up and appeal and say the judge was going to charge the jury incorrectly or the judge was going to admit inadmissible evidence and those are the reasons why I pleaded guilty. If you want to appeal those things, you need to specify that your guilty plea is subject to the reservation of the right to argue those things. And if you don't do that, and that doesn't get accepted as part of the guilty plea package by the government and the court, then you've given up the right to contest your guilt. And that's the situation you're in.
Your Honor, I don't think that the plea agreement is as clear as the court is characterizing it.
This is not about the plea agreement. It's about the plea of guilt.
The consequences of the plea of guilt is that you waive all non-jurisdictional defects to the proceeding. Is there anything that you can think of that you, under your theory, that you could not raise now? If your theory is correct, why just the specificity of the intent?
No, I can't think of anything, Your Honor, and that's simply because once Mr. Smith,
thereby, that's the problem.
But I think that he pled guilty on the understanding that his sentence was capped at 300 months.
Yeah, and he can challenge the sentence, but he can't challenge any other defects related to whether or not he committed the crime. That's our standard law of this circuit. Are you saying we should reverse our prior precedents?
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired.
Oh, you can answer that.
I can answer the question. No, Your Honor, I think that if anything, I think this that in this particular case, this I really do think that the plea agreement is what Mr. Smith was, the understanding that he was operating under and trial counsel was operating under, was that if he pled guilty and was sentenced to under 300 months, he couldn't appeal anything except for the denial of the motion to suppress. Because my time has expired, I'll reserve any remaining argument for rebuttal.
You've got 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Dallin. We'll now hear from Mr. Bagnola. How do you pronounce your name? Do you do the G hard or no?
I do the G hard, much to Judge Nardini's chagrin.
So, Mr. Bagnola, how do you pronounce it?
Bagnola. Yes, sir.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Anthony Bagnola. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of New York, and I represented the government in the proceedings below. This appeal fails for three distinct reasons, the first of which is that Mr. Smith's challenge to a denied jury instruction, along with all other non-jurisdictional defects, was waived when he pleaded guilty to participating in a gang-related double murder.
And so what's the consequence of that?
The consequence of his guilty plea, Your Honor, as you correctly noted earlier, is that this appeal is barred procedurally under Rule 11.
No, that's not the consequence. No. What does Rule 11 say?
Rule 11 says that when you knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily plead guilty, you're waiving your right to challenge non-jurisdictional defects in the proceedings below.
But that doesn't mean you can't appeal. The closing line of your argument on point one says, his appeal therefore should be dismissed. The appeal shouldn't be dismissed. You don't waive your right to appeal by pleading guilty. you waive your right to raise, to challenge your guilt. And so he's raising an argument that he's waived the right to raise, and that argument should be disregarded, and therefore the appeal should be, the conviction should be affirmed. But it's not like a, it's not like a plea agreement in which the person waives the right to appeal. When the person enters into agreement not to appeal, if the sentence is below a certain level, and that sentence is below the certain level, then it comes up on appeal, and we say, no, you've waived your right to appeal, so the appeal is dismissed. But by pleading guilty, you don't waive your right to appeal. You waive your right to challenge guilt. You can raise some things, you cannot raise others, but there's no waiver of the right to appeal. So you should be asking us to affirm, not to dismiss the appeal.
Yes, Your Honor, and pardon my less than careful choice of words there. I agree with the questions you posed to my friend about conflating the appeal waiver that could be inserted into a plea agreement with the procedural consequences under Rule 11 of a guilty plea. As a result of the specific argument that has been made to this court, namely challenging the denial of a jury instruction to a count that has since been dismissed with prejudice, I agree as a result of Rule 11, the conviction, the knowing, intelligent, and voluntary guilty plea he entered should be affirmed by this court.
That's what you say in your conclusion to the brief on page 42. You say, for these reasons, the foregoing judgment should be affirmed in all respects. But then on page 21, you said the appeal should therefore be dismissed. And one of the two, they can't both be right. And the one that's right is the one on the last page.
Yes, Your Honor. As to that point, Mr. Smith's brief identifies no problem with the validity of his guilty plea, and the record reveals none. Secondarily, even as setting aside the waiver under Rule 11, Smith's appeal relates not to the count of conviction, as Judge Sullivan pointed out, but to a count of the indictment that was dismissed with prejudice at the time of sentencing. He pled guilty to racketeering-related felony murder, and any interest he had in a jury instruction under 924J was extinguished, along with the counts of the indictment that charged him with that crime. This court's precedents regarding the mens rea for felony murder, including United States against Thomas, which Your Honor, Judge LaValle decided, have remained unchanged both before and after Rosemond. And third, even if as an academic matter the court were to reach the merits of this Rosemond issue, it would quickly realize that its decisions have repeatedly rejected any enhanced mens rea for felony murder. In any event, even comparing the facts of this case to Rosemond or even Judge Rakoff's decision in Giamfi is like comparing apples to wrenches. Those cases provide no support for a heightened mens rea for someone like Mr. Smith, who's not only a principal actor in the crime under consideration, but also admitted during his allocution to knowing that guns would be used during the robbery and that he and someone else could be seriously hurt as a result.
I've got something else I want to ask you about.
Yes.
The plea agreement, in addition to the appeal waiver, has this further provision. It says the defendant further waives the right to raise on appeal or on collateral review any argument that, one, the statutes to which defendant is pleading guilty is, I think it meant are, unconstitutional, and the admitted conduct does not fall within the scope of the statutes. Now, I couldn't figure out, on looking at that in the plea agreement, I couldn't figure out whether that's part of the appeal waiver, which only takes effect if the sentence is below a certain level, or whether it's something additional. Can you tell me the answer to that? Because in theory, I mean, I don't think it matters for purposes of this appeal, but I think going forward, if you include a clause like that in the plea agreement, it can be quite important to know whether it's part of the appeal waiver or whether it's an additional provision. Because the appeal waiver ceases to have any effect if, as in this case, the sentence is higher than the cutoff. So I don't know whether that provision is one that's binding or not binding, because if it's part of the appeal waiver, it's not binding because the sentence was higher. If it's not part of the appeal waiver, it then has effect. Can you answer those questions?
Well, preliminarily, I agree with Your Honor. I don't think that that clause is material to the argument.
No, it's not, but, it's quite an interesting point because it could be very important in this appeal.
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that that clause is in addition to the appeal waiver at 300 months, and like the waiver—
Meaning separate from the appeal.
That's right. And like,
so not conditional.
Not conditional. And like the—well, there was a conditional plea here, Your Honor, as you pointed out, only with respect to the suppression decision.
No, I mean, but it's not conditional on the sentence.
That's right. Just like the waiver—just like the appellate waiver does not bar a subsequent claim based on ineffective assistance of counsel, that additional language persists.
Let's go the other way.
In the future, if you include a clause like that, I think you should be conscious of this problem and make it clear that it's something that is not subject to the cutoff sentence for its validity.
Yes, Your Honor. If the court has no other questions for me, the government will rest on its briefs. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Mr. Gowling, you have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to press one additional point or just remind the court that to the extent there is any ambiguity, Judge LaValle, in the provisions of the plea agreement or the extent to which they relate to one another, I think the court should construe the plea agreement strictly against the government and in Mr. Smith's favor. And with that, I don't have any further points. We'd rest on our briefs and the prior argument.
All right. Thank you both. We will reserve decision.